You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast, where we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer specializing in food and science. This podcast is all about nutrition in the community. I want to look at the concerns and risks facing vulnerable groups and communities with health inequalities. The latest insight into the role of nutrition in support of the body's defense against viral attack, what needs to be done to improve nutrition and health in communities. Now, in March 2020, the Director General of the WHO emphasized the importance of appropriate diet and lifestyle measures, including adequate nutrition to protect the immune system. Now we're in the middle of the coronavirus epidemic. I want to find out more. And we have three fantastic guests. We have Michael Baber, Director of Health Action Campaign.
Hello.
Alison Smith, Chair of the Older People Specialist Group of the British Dietetic Association.
Hello.
And Dwayne Meller, Senior Teaching Fellow, Aston Medical School.
Hi.
Dwayne, if we can just start off with you, and what do we mean by nutrition in the community? Why is that different from nutrition anywhere else?
Well, everywhere is a community, so it's food eaten everywhere. I think in the context of what we're looking at today, it covers aspects of rehabilitation. So it's people who have been ill, who are recuperating, including older people who may need more nutrition. But also on the other side, it includes people managing and wanting to prevent chronic diseases such as type 2 diabetes and sort of manage their weight and maybe get a little bit slimmer.
Okay. Well, let's have a look at who are these groups, really, I suppose. Michael, who do we consider to be most vulnerable?
Well, at least three groups, I'd say. We've got elderly, particularly elderly housebound in care homes and care settings. We've got people from Black and minority ethnic communities. You've also got groups with underlying health conditions, and not least, people who are obese. So at least three groups there, each of whom in different ways is vulnerable.
Okay. Now, Alison, I mean, you're chair of the Older People Specialist Group. Is nutrition a vital part of the body's defence against viruses amongst the people that you are looking at?
Yes, definitely. I think nutrition is one of the things that we're really keen to try and increase knowledge and understanding about for older people. And that's older people anywhere. It doesn't just have to be in care homes. Obviously, we've seen a lot of stories about care homes in the news recently, but it's people in their own homes as well. And it's something that a lot of people are simply unaware about, that nutritional needs change as we get older. So the thing that's right for somebody, a younger adult, say, is not necessarily what's right for an older person, particularly somebody who's a bit more dependent or a bit more vulnerable. And so it really does help in protecting the body against all manner of things, but it certainly helps in protection against viruses and any other health problem for that matter.
Okay, now Dwayne, there have been a huge amount of changes to the way we eat, exercise habits, what we do during lockdown. Do these changes affect what our nutritional needs are?
Well, a lot of people will be less active, although sort of with changing rules and lockdown, that encourages to be more physically active and get outside more. So a lot of people may be changing how they're exercising for leisure, but their working habits, their commuting habits will be reduced. So the amount of energy they need is less, but the amount of vitamins and minerals won't be affected as much. They'll be the same. So it's actually getting that better quality diet, which can be a challenge. And then we have sort of the issues of sort of limitations on getting to shops. We cannot easily just pop to shops as some of us may have done before. So it's actually planning shopping and being more prepared for the meals we're eating over the week and sort of our eating behavior. Because one of the problems a lot of people are finding when they're in home all the time is that temptation to snack because they haven't got that regular routine. So it's a whole shift in how we're living our lives, which interacts with how we then choose our food and then share our food, because we've lost the ability to eat out. So there's a whole range of things from a behavioural point of view and a sociological point of view, which is really impacting how we're eating at the moment.
From your point of view, Dwayne, is this, as well as being a huge problem, is this an opportunity to look at the effect of nutrition and lifestyle, or is it just a disaster because it's very difficult to analyse those things?
I think there's two points there. One is that it is very difficult to look at what is happening right now, but I think there's a really good opportunity here for us as individuals, as families, as communities, and as a nation to look at how we eat and how perhaps we want to try and move out of this into the next phase of what people are terming a new normal. Is this an opportunity to look at how we choose our food and look at the food we eat and try and be both sustainable, because a lot of people are talking about sustainability moving out of lockdown, but also look how we can be healthier, because we have a number of issues about rehabilitation of the people who've been ill, but also people who may be wanting to reduce their risk of another risk factor. So we've looked at sort of weight gain and metabolic health linked to cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes, but now it's sort of being shown up in terms of possibly linked to sort of this COVID-19 SARS condition. So we've got another reason, but we need to do it in a way that supports people to make changes and change how we buy food, eat food, prepare food and share food.
From what we've seen, the lockdown seems to be reinforcing the existing health divide in the UK. So for example, a recent survey during the lockdown found that 40% of people surveyed were eating more fruit and veg, 50% eating more home-cooked meals, and 48% eating less fat food and takeaways. It all sound good. But then if you look at the other end of the spectrum, there's often a very different picture. So one of our advisors works in public health for a local authority. Before the lockdown, she ran face-to-face weight loss groups that unhealthy diets. Now, of course, this has stopped, and they found most of their clients have reverted back to their previous unhealthy diet and lack of exercise. She reports lots of our clients have fed back, they are eating and drinking more due to stress, anxiety, boredom, and change of routine. So it does seem that the health conscious are taking opportunity, perhaps they don't have to to work, for example, getting a bit more exercise, a bit more home cooking. But at the other end of the spectrum, those who perhaps already have health problems, diet related, it may be making the situation worse.
So what are the underlying factors here? I mean, we're talking about food poverty in certain areas. Are we looking at food deserts, lack of knowledge of cooking, lack of aptitude to cook, price of food? What are the primary causes of the problems?
There have been problems in terms of within COVID, in terms of food availability, again, for people who are perhaps vulnerable. But there's also a quite interesting point that if you look at the three groups that I mentioned earlier who are particularly vulnerable, elderly and housebound, black and minority ethnic background, or obese, there's one thing they all have in common. They're at increased risk of vitamin D deficiency. Now, COVID-19 is too recent for there to be any peer-reviewed evidence available. What we do know is that one, COVID-19 is an acute respiratory disease. Two, vitamin D protects against acute respiratory tract infection. Three, medically prescribed vitamin D supplementation is safe. And as of today at least, four different universities have now identified a correlation between vitamin D deficiency and higher COVID 90 deaths. They're not suggesting that vitamin D will stop getting COVID-19, but it does appear that there's a strong association with protective adverse effects, reducing your risk of dying, reducing your risk of serious complications. So from our point of view, until at least there's peer-reviewed evidence, if it doesn't harm us to take medically appropriate levels of vitamin D, and it could avoid serious complications and death, this seems like quite a cost-effective approach that's going to help at least three different vulnerable groups.
So, as a consequence of that, what is the obvious thing to do?
I'd say make it available in care homes, to frontline NHS workers who are from black and minority ethnic backgrounds, and to obese patients coming into hospital, at least as the first three actions you can take. There's a whole set of other actions, obviously, you need to take to deal with the underlying socioeconomic problems, but that's not a quick fix. Vitamin D seems to be a rather quicker option in the current crisis.
Alison and Duane, what are your views on vitamin D supplementation?
I think from From a care home perspective, it's something I've long thought this is something that care homes should be providing. In my day job, I'm a prescribing support dietitian, so I actually look at appropriate prescribing of everything related to nutrition. And I'm very much in favour of actually these being supplements that people purchase, but that we help people to understand the need to do this. Because actually, to purchase enough vitamin D for a year is about £10. So it's a really, really cheap thing. Whereas sadly, the NHS pays us considerably more for the same product. It's one of these mad things that we find with all sorts of nutritional products. What we as members of the public would pay in, say, a supermarket is vastly different from what the NHS pays. So much as I appreciate there will be some people who will have genuine deficiencies and will need a higher amount prescribed, for a lot of people in terms of maintaining or preventing insufficiency, then I would basically say purchasing it from a supermarket is probably going to be the best bet. But that means we need kind of to really highlight this to members of the public and within care homes to say this is okay to do. It's still a case of talk to your GP about it, obviously, but actually it's still an okay thing to do. And it basically meets exactly what you're saying, Michael, of actually having this on a regular basis. And certainly for the older people population, particularly now that people are much more in their own homes, I would absolutely agree with that.
And Duane, is this the obvious low-hanging fruit?
If we look at it, so Public Health England have repurposed their recommendation that sort of over winter people take 10 micrograms of vitamin D. And one of the issues with vitamin D dosing is it comes in international units and micrograms, and that confuses the public. So I'm just going to talk about micrograms to keep it simple. Is that 10 microgram recommendation is throughout because they recognise people are inside more. When we're actually looking at vitamin D deficiency, we can go from what's known as rickets or sort of weakened bones, which is osteopenia and osteomalacia in adults, through to suboptimal blood levels. And again, the literature is very confused there. One thing to be careful when we're talking about vitamin D is because it's a fat-soluble vitamin, there is an upper threshold because our bodies are not good at excreting it. So higher doses or anything that would mean taking over 100 micrograms a day is not recommended. There's some suggestions and some advocates which have links to the supplement industry, so we need to bear that in mind when we're critically evaluating the evidence, are suggesting is 25 micrograms per day. That's probably okay for most people, but sort of to err on the side of caution, in other areas of the world where they have vitamin D fortified food products as a major part of their food supply, we don't tend to have that much in the UK. It's only in a few cereals, and we don't even tend to have it in margarine because people have moved to spreads now. The 10 microgram is a definite safe one. The 25 microgram is possible, but I wouldn't recommend that for everybody.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a really interesting, very specific thing to think about. But Michael, a lot of the things that we've mentioned already, things like, food poverty and the obvious. I mean, this is flipping. It's not brain surgery. We know a lot of this stuff already. We know that bad diets cause problems. Why the hell can't we solve this?
It requires action, essentially by government. If you think about it, at the moment, if you live in a poor or deprived area, what kind of food is easily available? What's easily affordable? What's convenient if you're short of time or you can't cook very well? What's heavily promoted through advertising? It's usually food that's high in sugar and salt. It's been heavily processed. It doesn't contain the nutrients that are, the vitamins, the minerals, the fiber that's going to be good for our health. But it's cheap and available and convenient. And for some people, it's what they've been eating all their life. So it's what they're used to. So if you're going to turn that around, you're unlikely to get millions of people to change the habits of a lifetime by giving them advice. There are too many factors.
But that's exactly what we need to do, isn't it?
No.
Aha, okay.
I would say that advice works up to a point. I suspect when we've researched, most people know what's healthy and most people know what isn't. They know that it's to eat some fruit and veg. They know that it's good to get some exercise. They know that junk food is great for their health. The problem is, how do you get people to act on what they know? And at the moment in the UK, we've got this sort of health divide where health conscious people hear, understand, and on a good day, act on the evidence. They don't always do that. On a good day, they do. And then the other part of society, as I've explained, for all sorts of reasons, don't. So we can't just keep on churning out information. And the other thing about health information, give it, is that you're competing with a huge and much greater amount of much more sophisticated advertising of less health products. I mean, the simple example, in 2018, the government's allocated, I think it was about 4.8 million to Change for Life, to promote healthy snacks. Now, that sounds very good, 4.8 million. However, if you look at, say, Kit Kat, a small chocolate bar, they spend 5 million a year advertising. So the entire budget for healthy snacks was less than the advertising budget for a single chocolate bar. And it's not just the volume, it's that the advertising for less healthy products is more seductive. It's beautifully lit, great soundtrack, visually attractive, it often tugs on the heartstrings, it's got humour. Compare that with your average public health messaging. And it's a bit like a non-league side trying to take on the Premier League all combined.
Are you saying that the Eat Well plate isn't sexy?
Yeah. Well, that's it. It's like Roundheads and Cavaliers. The Roundheads are right, you know, they're right, but the Cavaliers are more interesting and exciting, you know, so they get the attention.
Oh, so it's like politics in Britain. Now, Alison, I'm really interested in you because you've got a very specialist group, the older people group. Now, older people are not stupid. They are full of knowledge. A lot of them have huge amounts of ability to cook. Why are they such a problematic area in terms of nutrition?
I'd say partly it's because of the public health messaging that and this is very much a personal view, but it is echoed by other dietitians working in this field, that we feel that a lot of older people really do listen to public health messaging. So much as I totally agree with Michael that there is a challenge in terms of actually people taking on the public health messaging, I think a lot of older people really do listen to it and they take it on. The challenge is because actually one size doesn't fit all. And if you're an older person and you're exercise is less, your appetite is less, you may have chronic health problems, so there are lots of things going on in your life. Actually, what you don't necessarily need to be doing is following exactly the same healthy diet as the rest of the population. You still need a full range of nutrients, you still need enough protein in your diet, you still need enough vitamins and minerals, you may need slightly less in the way of calories, but actually what you can find is that people start to limit their food intake more than perhaps they need to, don't necessarily make the right choices, and don't combine foods in the right way. So obviously older people will need fruit and vegetables as well, but sometimes they will need them combined with foods that have a higher protein content, say, basically, so that they're actually getting enough of all the different nutrients. And the problem is we actually have absolutely no public health messaging talking about what is a healthy diet for older people. And that's quite a lack, because we know that we have a high rate of malnutrition in older people in this country. The statistics at the moment are still thinking that probably 10% of over 65s are malnourished. The older people live, the greater their likelihood of developing malnutrition. The more dependent people are as they get older, the greater their likelihood of becoming malnourished. We know malnutrition is a significant problem in care homes, and it's something I'm interested to find out if at some point down the line we're able to look at this evidence to see actually the people in care homes who have sadly died from COVID, what their nutritional status was. Because obviously I suspect we'll find that it's a different cohort to people, obviously, where we know with slightly younger people, where there's a greater likelihood of severe consequences. If people are overweight, people have diabetes. I wonder whether we'll find a slightly different cohort in care homes.
But in care homes, I don't understand how this can be. Can you explain to me how, when your diet is controlled, not controlled, it is supplied by the institution itself, how can you still be malnourished?
I think it's a multifactorial thing. I think what you have to remember for people people living in care homes are, generally speaking, if you're living in a care home, it's because you're not able to look after yourself anymore. And I think we as a population, we probably still have quite a rose-tinted view of what a care home is. So any views you have that care homes are sort of, you know, these lovely places where sort of people go to retire and potter around doing their garden is not really what you see these days. Basically, care homes these days look after people who are very dependent, very vulnerable. A lot of people in care homes, the vast majority, will have some degree of cognitive impairment, so dementia or the beginnings of dementias. And we do know very clearly that dementias have a huge impact on nutritional intake, people's desire to eat, and they also have a huge impact on the body's metabolism as well. So actually, we're looking after the most vulnerable group in society. And you can start to improve people's nutrition in a lot of cases, but you cannot improve it for every single person, because at the end of the day, we can't make people eat if they don't want to. We can encourage, we can support, we can help, we can advise, but actually people, whether they have cognitive impairment or not, do still have the right to say no, and that's okay. We need to still support them if we possibly can, but I think it's having a consistent message going into care homes, it's having a consistent message coming sort of from the NHS, it's having a consistent message coming from government, and it's also having a consistent message to the public, because actually everybody in a care home has relatives. Whether they visit or not is a different thing, but everybody in a care home has relatives. And actually, working with care homes for a number of years, it astounds me how many older people's relatives simply don't recognise that unplanned weight loss in their loved one is a bad thing, because we're so focused these days on the problem of obesity, which is huge in the wider population and is something we absolutely need to try and tackle. But actually, it makes people think that every person who loses weight, it's a good thing. It's a positive. And the thing is, when you're a vulnerable elderly person, unplanned weight loss is very rarely a positive. And actually, that should be almost like a red flag to us to go, there's something wrong here. We need to try and help support this person. But instead, we often just go, oh, well, great. You know, they were a little bit overweight. They needed to lose weight. It's fine. And actually, that's not really the case.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, Duane, who's to blame for all this? You know, you've been on TV talking about the science and food and you know, trying to explain how food works. Why doesn't the message get through? Why don't people understand food? Or, you know, is it the government with their boring message that teenagers really would rather stick pins in their eyes than listen to? Or is that because institutions have to do that? I just don't get why we can't crack this one.
I think we are making baby steps in some areas. The idea in advertising, as mentioned earlier, that sort of the snack food industry are better at advertising to the target groups than maybe the health messages. But the eat them to defeat them is getting some interesting evaluations, and it'd be interesting to see what comes out this year. The idea of gamification, so turning being healthy into being the easiest burn, enjoyable thing to do rather than being a chore is one thing. And there are examples. If we look at some of the work that was done back in the 80s with California raisins, although possibly not the perfect snack, you know, it's better than a lot of the options. Everyone remembers that advert of those singing raisins. And it's getting that sort of approach to come through. We've seen it in other countries where they've had a guy running through the park with a carrot in his pocket, making jokes about it. He's got a carrot in his pocket, or please to see me. We need to make it fun and different, rather than being the thing that, yeah, we rebel against. We should rebel to being healthy. It is very complicated, but we are getting there a little bit. And at a government level, it is challenging, because they have massive amounts of food industry which pay tax. How do we re-engineer our food system and our agricultural system, which has been developed since the Second World War to supply the energy needs of a growing country, to one that supports health? We need to reconfigure our food system. That is possible. It is not easy, but it's possible. It is a good thing to do. And hopefully the review of the food system will do that and start putting those measures in place so our food actually makes people healthier. The challenge, as sort of Alison was saying, in care homes, is we have this idea of an increasing level of frailty of people losing weight. On the same side, we've got obesity seen as a general population. How do we get a message that actually links those two together, but allows us to individualize at different times of people's lives and different needs. That is a nuanced message, and that's a very hard thing to get across. If we want to think simply, which is not perfect, is in the care homes, people are losing weight, they're losing functional muscle. If you like, when we're talking about metabolic disease and obesity, that's possibly where there's issues that there's not enough muscle exercising. And you can have what's known as sarcopenic obesity. So you can have very overweight individuals which have got less muscle mass, and they're the ones really at the risk of disease. So we get very hung up on this idea of weight and being overweight. Being underweight and frail, that's clear that is a problem. But it's about getting people to maintain that muscle mass, the way of being active to do that, but also the way of eating to do that. And then we can draw out these nuances. It is very, very challenging, but there are little steps that are showing signs that we can do this, and we need to do this to actually be healthy and as a population, as individuals. That was another point, but I can't remember what that was. It'll come back to me.
Don't worry. Okay, Michael, we're sort of talking about ideas of solutions. We're talking about specifics of certain things you can do, vitamin D and things like that. Is it a question of specific solutions, or really do we need some sort of systemic change? Is this about poverty rather than about nutrition?
It's partly about poverty. It's also partly about education. The health divide tends to go pretty much along the educational grounds. What we now know is that about half of young people, just going back to that point about them, about half of young people are now going to university, which means they are more likely to make healthy choices in the future. And in fact, if you look at data from the Office for National Statistics, the age group that is most health conscious, that's eating more fruit and veg, that's taking more exercise, that's smoking less, drinking less alcohol, is actually 18 to 24-year-olds. And we did some research with students in London and found a very similar picture. So if you take a very long-term perspective, education as it grows is going to hopefully help along, you know, that's a separate factor, as it were, from poverty. It's all, obviously, socioeconomic issues are really huge. And that's not something there's a quick fix for, in the way that, you know, you can give vitamin D and that may protect up to a certain point in a certain situation. I'm slightly more optimistic about Duane's point about re-engineering the food industry, in that there's a lot of work been going on behind the scenes. I mean, the food industry knows that the things are changing, knows that there's some change in consumer attitude. A growing interest in healthier food, particularly since a lot of media coverage about sugar, Jamie Oliver, and so on. And they must have thought, well, at some stage, we're making a government that's going to intervene, not just have voluntary approaches, but mandate that we do things. So behind the scenes, there's quite a lot going on. And for example, it's now possible to reduce levels of sugar and salt in mass-produced food without using an artificial alternative. There are things like Tate & Lyle's SodaLone, basically restructures salt so your tongue gets the same salt taste with a lower volume of salt. An Israeli company, Dumatop, have done something similar for sugar, flavor delivery particles. Your tongue gets the same taste of sweetness, but with a lower volume. So those are just a couple of examples of ways in which the food industry could, without losing its customers, without taste radically changing, make useful changes that reduce the harmful ingredients. And we saw a few years ago the incremental approach with salt, reducing levels of salt in bread, for example. If you do it gradually over a number of years, people don't notice the difference. If you like, it's stealth, kind of stealth approach to improving health. So re-engineering the food industry, I think, is possible. But it does require government intervention. I think it was a few years ago now that the big consultancy firm McKinsey said, well, if you're really going to tackle obesity, for example, you have to have government mandating that the food industry produces healthy food. And the British Retail Consortium has been saying that for a number of years now. They want a level playing field. If everyone is expected to produce healthy food, then there's no competitive advantage by not producing healthier food. So I think there are ways this can be done. And a good analogy here, I think, is with smoking. People smoked for decades. It took sustained government action by government, and now less than 15% of the UK population smoke. So it's going to need something fairly similar, I think, by the government in relation to food.
Dwayne, what's your view on government intervention? Does it work, or do food companies either find their way around it, or do consumers find their way around interventions?
There are examples of good interventions, not necessarily through the intervention itself, but if you look at the very casually named soft drinks industry levy, or sugar tax as most people call it, that helped sort of drive reformulation of the beverage industry in the UK very rapidly, probably sort of 18 months ahead of where it would have been. However, if we're looking at dietary recommendations, they've been critiqued, not necessarily because the recommendations themselves are wrong, they're not based on perfect evidence, but possibly some of the better evidence that's available. But they allow room for recommendations or claims to be made on food where they may have one aspect of it, such as being low in fat, but they don't necessarily match up on the other side in terms of, you know, being low in sugar. You know, you could put on a bag of sugar that it's cholesterol free. It's completely meaningless, but it's true. Yeah. So there are ways that it can work and it might not work. I think sort of the other issue we need to look at is actually how we make it a level playing field for people in their homes to eat. You know, food poverty is one thing, but kitchen poverty is also a reality. If you haven't got that much of a fridge or a you only got a microwave and a hob top, how do you cook? If you've only got one cupboard you can keep food in, and that might have damp in it. It's a very complicated thing. And the other thing, which probably has driven some of the changes in food, I'm going to use some very buzzy sociology words, which I apologise, is something called McDonaldization and aculturalization. So we've got this idea of all these different ways of eating that have come across the country and the whole across the world to the UK are being merged. And when you merge ways of eating, you tend to get the higher fat, the higher sugar, the tastiest version of it, rather than looking back, what's a basic English dish? It's probably something like a hot pot. What's the traditional French dish? It's probably a bean stew. If you go to the sort of across to Southeast Asia, it's a dal. They're very simple dishes, which are basically, when we talk about a Mediterranean way of eating, you know, that is what it's about. It's about eating food that's available and as fresh as possible. We need to make that available to people. We need to give them the access and the ability to eat it and enjoy it, rather than just having this sort of perfect storm of very tasty but not necessarily the most healthy food available. And governments could actually help influence that by possibly looking at how things are priced, and actually working a way that makes things work for business and for people. You know, there are examples of hospitals I know in Melbourne in Australia where they've actually worked with their food suppliers to find a way of making their food supply and their beverage supply healthy that actually is positive for business. And you can get the two to work together. We can't make the food industry the victim all the time. We need to get young people interested in the food business so actually they can help solve these problems and make it profitable and make it work. Otherwise, you know, there's no incentive for the business to change. And I think Michael was right. There is a certain awareness in business that if they don't change, they're putting their bottom lines at risk.
Yeah. Okay, we have run out of time. I've got one more question I'd like to ask each of you. The question I wrote was, what's the simple low-hanging fruit solution? It doesn't have to be a fruit. What's the simple low-hanging solution that would affect most people? I don't think that's really the right thing to say, because simple low-hanging fruit is not the way to create a long-lasting change. So instead, what is the first thing you would like to see happen on the road to improving nutrition in the community? Alison, could you answer that first? What's the one thing that you would like to see happen?
The thing that I would like to see happen is a recognition that, as far as nutritional needs are concerned, one size doesn't fit all, and that there, and exactly as Dwayne has said, there are nuances to this. It's incredibly challenging for government, and I totally understand that. But the difficulty is we're in a current situation where we simply have one message, which is basically the Eat Well guide, and it doesn't necessarily apply to every single group of the population equally. So I would like to see some different messaging. Now, having said that, the British Dietetic Association has already agreed to produce some guidance looking at basically older people's nutritional needs, which is supported by NHS England, because we totally understand and accept that Public Health England isn't necessarily going to be able to do this. But that's really the thing I would like to have. And in an ideal world, I'd love it to be something that sort of everyone in the population understands, that, you know, effectively the low salt, low sugar, low fat message is important. But there's also a slightly nuanced message about nutrient dense diet for older people that we kind of need to understand too.
Excellent. Okay. Michael, what's the one big change you would like to see in the near future?
Probably any action that makes healthy choices easy choices. And what that probably means is the government recognising that voluntary approaches have value, but don't reach all parts of the food industry and all consumers. And therefore, there is a need mandate to try to ensure that mass produced food is basically healthier. That way, when people go to the shop to buy food, you have it at a stroke, improve their nutrition.
Excellent. Okay. Dwayne, what's on your radar as the first thing you would like to see done to help?
Can I say two things and cheat? Healthy stuff fun. So being healthy is fun. And the other one is every time a fast food restaurant closes down, the pop-up healthy food recycling or food reusing shop takes its place. So that helps train the local community in ways of eating healthily, but also provides healthy, fun food at low cost or no cost for those who can't afford it, and change our high streets so we have these changing food outlets.
Gosh, I hope that does happen. That sounds like a genius idea. Well, thank you so much to all of you for joining us. And let's catch up on this to see how it evolves and to see if coronavirus has had any effect on how this unfolds. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast from Food Matters with Michael Baber, Alison Smith, and Dwayne Meller, and myself, Stefan Gates. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from salmon farm sustainability to vegetable picking robots. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Goodbye. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.